You are listening to a sermon by Thomas Bergen, recorded on Sunday, June 12, 2016, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Please join me if you know it. This land is your land, this land is my land, from Bonavista to Vancouver Island, from the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake waters. This land was made for and me.
Okay, that's
like a different version than I learned from.
Yeah, you're American.
From California to the New York Island.
So the original is actually American, but I learned it, and everyone here learned it in Canadian schools where we have a Canadian version. Yeah. Good. So, back in elementary school, I didn't really know much about the way the world really worked, but I learned this song, and I was inspired by its vision of a world with peaceful coexistence and land equality. And the song made realizing that vision sound as easy as catching the tune of the song, right? But then, while I was still in elementary school, I learned three other land-sharing lessons. The recess lesson, the private property lesson, and the social studies lesson. And these lessons revealed a bit more about how the world actually worked. According to the recess lesson, there were the big fields with the big nets where the big kids played soccer, and then there were the little fields with no nets where the little kids played. Of course, the teachers told us that we were free to play wherever we wanted, but they were wrong. Another lesson was the private property lesson. During one of our lunch breaks at school, some friends and I wandered far from the watchful eye of a supervising teacher into an adjacent farm field. At some point, we saw a man coming after us and yelling at us. He wasn't singing, "This land is your land." He was swearing, telling us to get off his property, his private property. Finally, there is the social studies lesson. In the social studies lesson, I learned that this land of Canada had not always been your land and my land. It had been other people's lands. And many times the way this land became your land and my land was through taking that land away from others through war. Well, the land sharing lessons didn't stop for me after elementary school. If anything, I've come to see how absolutely central the issue of land is to our lives as human beings. How we share land, how we figure that out, how we negotiate that is so important. In my reading of history, it seems to me that almost every instance of armed human conflict has involved land as a contributing factor. As the population of the world continues to grow, it will become more and more important for us to learn the lessons of land sharing. Our peace and perhaps even our survival depend on it. My text this morning is 1 Kings 21, and you heard it read already from Doug here. There will be three main parts to my sermon. In the first and main part, I'll tell you the story in more detail of Ahab and Naboth. In the second part, I'll challenge you to think of parallels between the story of Ahab and Naboth and the stories of land dispossession throughout history. Finally, I'll end with three other land-sharing lessons from the story of Ahab and Naboth. New ones, not the ones from my elementary school experience. So first we'll learn the story of Ahab, then we'll consider how the story has continued to the present, and then we'll talk about how we can stop that story from continuing by putting into practice three land-sharing lessons. So let's begin with the story. I'll be going through it verse by verse, so I encourage you to grab your bulletins. And now I have to confess, I forgot to tell Andre to print off the verses in the NIV. So I'm going to be going through the NIV, you have the NRSV, but that's okay. We'll make it work. So verse 1, we'll start there. Sometime later, there was an incident involving a vineyard belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. The vineyard was in Jezreel, close to the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. So our story begins sometime later after the contest of Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. At this point in the book of Kings, Ahab has already had many incidents with the prophets of Yahweh, especially Elijah. He is described as a king who did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than all his predecessors. Many commentators suggest that this particular incident of King Ahab is his last and most egregious incident of wickedness, since his death in the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead follows immediately after this. The geographical setting for our story is the Jezreel Valley, one of the most fertile parts of Israel both now and then. When the rest of the country goes brown and dry, the Jezreel Valley remains green, so it's not surprising that King Ahab wanted a summer palace here. While peering down into the valley, Ahab notices a vineyard belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. Now, the name, Naboth the Jezreelite, is significant, I think. Naboth isn't just Naboth the atomistic individual. He is Naboth the Jezreelite. The land of Jezreel is part of the identity of this Naboth. By contrast, the land of Jezreel is for Ahab his vacation home, and Naboth's vineyard looks like a great place for a vegetable patch. Verse 2, Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use for a vegetable garden, since it is close to my palace. In exchange, I will give you a better vineyard, or, if you prefer, I will pay you whatever it is worth." Verse 2. Ahab's rationale for wanting the vineyard is straightforward. It's convenient. It's close to his palace. And on first glance, his offer to Naboth seems fair. In exchange for Naboth's vineyard, King Ahab will give Naboth an even better vineyard, or he will pay him the market value for his. As far as King Ahab is concerned, he is offering to make a fair business transaction. Verse 3. But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." What Ahab doesn't realize is that for Naboth, not all vineyards are created equal. The worth of his inherited vineyard is unparalleled to another vineyard and unequal to a sum of money. To understand Naboth's refusal, we need to look again at that extraordinary passage in Leviticus 25, especially verse 23. "The land must not be sold permanently," or in perpetuity, like that word I can't pronounce in the NRSV, "because the land is mine and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers." So that's the command. The land must not be sold permanently. According to the law, the land in Israel was a gift. And the people who lived on the land were not landowners, but land leaseholders. God was the formal landowner of all the land in Israel. When the Israelites bought and sold land from one another, they were really buying and selling temporary use of the land according to the number of crop years left till the year of Jubilee. Then, in the year of Jubilee, all the land that had been bought and sold would be returned to its original owner, or more accurately, leaseholder. The reason Naboth refuses Ahab's offer is that Naboth understands his own land to be part of the promised land, a gift held in trust from God, a gift that cannot be sold. For Naboth, his land is an ancestral inheritance. For Ahab, by contrast, land is a transferable commodity. Verse 4. "So Ahab went home, sullen and angry, because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, 'I will not give you the inheritance of my ancestors.' He lay on his bed, sulking, and refused to eat." Ahab's sullen and angry reaction reminds me of my little nieces and nephews. But I think there is more going on than King Ahab acting like a 2-year-old because he couldn't get the toy he wanted. The words sullen and angry, kar and za'if, are the exact same words used to describe King Ahab's behavior in the immediately preceding chapter, 1 Kings chapter 20. In that chapter, a nameless prophet confronts King Ahab for shirking his kingly duties. And in response, the king leaves sullen and angry, kar and za'if, the exact same words as in our passage. Perhaps Naboth, like the nameless prophet in chapter 20, reminded Ahab of his kingly duties, and thus provoked the same response, the same feelings in Ahab. According to Psalm 107, the king of Israel's duties and responsibilities included providing land for his people. Providing land, it says, for the hungry in which they might live, establish towns, sow fields, and plant vineyards. As Ahab lay on his bed, sulking and refusing to eat, I wonder if he was working through a much bigger question than, why can't I have Naboth's vineyard? I wonder if Naboth's refusal provoked a sort of identity crisis for Ahab. What kind of king am I? What does it mean for me to be this king? And who does this lowly Israelite think he is standing up to me? So, next verse, verse 5. His wife Jezebel came in and asked him, "Why are you so sullen? Why won't you eat?" Jezebel picks up that there's something very strange going on about Ahab's behavior, and she's going to figure out what it is. So verse 6, he answered her, "Because I said to Naboth the Jezreelite, 'Sell me your vineyard, or if you prefer, I will give you another vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" Jezebel hears Ahab's words, but more importantly, I think she hears the tone behind them. Ahab is unsure of himself. He's wavering. He's asking himself, do I want to be an Israelite king who represents the God of Naboth? A God who owns the land and wants me to administer it for the flourishing of my people? Or do I want to be like a Canaanite king? A Canaanite king with power to have any vineyard or anything he wants? Jezebel, who is herself the daughter of a Canaanite king, knows how to help Ahab work through his identity crisis and answer those questions. Verse 7. Jezebel, his wife, said, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? Is this how you govern? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." Queen Jezebel scolds Ahab for his unkingly behavior and proceeds to take matters into her own hands. She will show Ahab what it means to be a king where she comes from. Verse 8. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him. While Ahab sulks in his bed, Jezebel gets to work in Ahab's name. She will rid Ahab of his troublesome Naboth. Her strategy is cunning and clever. She forges letters with the royal seal and gets the elders and nobles of the city involved in her plot. Verse 9. In those letters she wrote, "Proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people." The first step in Jezebel's scheme is to invent a crisis. In the Bible, the proclamation of a fast occurred because of a crisis. Because the community's relationship with God was out of joint, the purpose of the fast was for the community to figure out how that relationship was out of joint and why this crisis was happening. Of course, Jezebel's fast is a bogus fast, but the villagers don't know it. Only the elders and nobles do. So they fast, worried that their relationship with God has been ruptured by something or somebody in the community. And the real irony here is that they should, in this fast, realize that the problem, the rupture in the community, the way that the relationship with God is out of joint is because of Ahab and Jezebel. But instead they're going to find somebody else. So verse 10. "But seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them bring charges that he has cursed both God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death." The word scoundrels here is not quite strong enough. What the NIV and the NRSV render as scoundrels is actually a title reserved for the worst characters in the Old Testament. It literally means sons of worthlessness. And the word worthlessness in Hebrew comes from beli, without, and ya'el, worth, without worth, Belial. And perhaps you recognize that word. It's one of the titles for Satan in the New Testament. Belial. So these men are not just scoundrels. Right? They're sons of Belial. Another issue of translation in this particular passage is the third person rendering of "he has cursed both God and the king." Most manuscripts render this in the second person. In other words, Jezebel is instructing the elders to instruct the sons of Belial to say to Naboth, "You have cursed." To face Naboth, look him in the eyes and say, "You have cursed." But then when the moment comes in verse 13, they don't actually have the courage to look him in the face. They don't say to Naboth's face, "You have cursed." They talk about it in the abstract. "He has cursed." As for Naboth, he will not be able to speak again in this story. He will be silenced by the other characters. In fact, he will not even be given the dignity of being addressed. Verse 11. So the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city did as Jezebel directed in the letters she had written to them. It's such a simple sentence. They did as the letters directed. But why? Why did they go along with this terrible evil? Why were they unquestioningly compliant? Perhaps they wanted to gain a favorable eye from the king and queen with regard to their own future requests. But then Jezebel's letters never make any promises to these elders and nobles. Perhaps they had something against Naboth to begin with, but then the text never suggests anything along those lines. More likely, the answer is a lot simpler and a lot scarier. These elders and nobles were used to doing what they were told, and they were used to enjoying the royal benefits of being on the right side of power. So they went along with it. They did as directed. Verse 12. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth in a prominent place among the people. In this verse, there's an eerily accurate echo of Jezebel's instructions. The narrator tells us that the nobles and elders are just falling in line. They're doing exactly as instructed. The fast is proclaimed, Naboth is put in a prominent place, and Jezebel's plan works itself out perfectly. And convenient for Jezebel, too, they are the ones doing it, right? The community will never suspect that there's a royal plot behind Ahab's land grab, and even if they do suspect something, she'll be able to disavow any involvement. It's they are doing it. Verse 13. Then two scoundrels came and sat opposite him and brought charges against Naboth before the people, saying, Naboth has cursed both God and the king. So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death. Verse 13 highlights the role of the people, the townsfolk, in Naboth's murder. It brings the horror of Naboth's murder into sharper relief. Verse 13 reminds us that this story is not just about an evil queen and her victim. It's the story about elders and nobles, villagers, the people, the scoundrel, who collaborate together to murder an innocent man under state watch. You'd think that there would have been at least somebody in the community who would have stuck up their neck for Naboth, but the text tells us of no such person. Several weeks ago, Andre preached a sermon on the end of sacrifice, and he introduced you to the scapegoat theorist René Girard. The story of Naboth's murder by a mob at a religious festival, it's a classic case of scapegoating. The people need a culprit who can be blamed for the crisis in the community, and the leaders need an excuse to get rid of a particular person. Together, it's a terrible combination, demonic even. The murder of Naboth is inspired by the sons of Belial and accomplished by the satanic mechanism of scapegoating. Verse 14. Then they sent word to Jezebel, Naboth has been stoned to death. Naboth has been stoned to death. Not we have stoned Naboth to death, just the facts. Naboth has been stoned to death. Objective reporting. Verse 15, and I apologize, you don't have verse 15 and 16, but I'm going to carry on. This is verse 15. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned to death, she said to Ahab, get up and take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite that he has refused to sell you. He is no longer alive, but dead. The fact that Jezebel tells Ahab to get up suggests that Ahab still hasn't moved from his bed. While all of this action has been happening outside, Ahab has remained willfully oblivious. Jezebel's report to Ahab is just like the elders and nobles' report to Jezebel. Objective. He's no longer alive, but dead. Jezebel doesn't give any more details, and Ahab doesn't ask any more questions. Verse 16. When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, he got up and went down to take possession of Naboth's vineyard. Ahab's greed is what set all of these events in motion, and although he has not been part of the action directly, he has been complicit in the crime of Naboth's murder. Ahab is happy to have a new vineyard, but he prefers not to ask how he came to possess it. According to Psalm 107, which I've already referenced, the role of the king was to administer the land so that the hungry might live, establish towns, sow fields, and plant vineyards in it. In taking away the land from Naboth, Ahab reverses what God did for Israel under Joshua. And in this act of dispossession, Ahab also turns his back on his responsibilities as king. So let's stop there. We'll take a moment to gather our thoughts. We've just spent a significant amount of time working through a text carefully, right? We've just heard a story of greed-inspired, state-sanctioned land grabbing. Another theme, we just heard a story of a silenced victim who tried in vain to resist being bought off his land. We've heard the story of a community scapegoating crime covered up by false religious and legal legitimations. The story of those who are complicit in injustice avoiding asking any questions. These are all stories within this story. And now that we've heard this story, I want to transition to the second part of my sermon. What are some ways you think that maybe you've seen this story of Ahab and Naboth continue? How has the story of greed-inspired, state-sanctioned land grab continued to our present day? What about the story of silenced victims who are bought off their land? What about the story about Jezebel's elders and nobles who hide their greed with legal legitimations? What about the story of communities turning a blind eye when the innocent among them are scapegoated? And what about the story of Ahabs who are complicit in injustices they would rather not ask any questions about? So perhaps we can talk about that during our discussion time. I want to give one example. And it's from the farming history of Canada, actually. So in his book, The End of Food, I should just back up. We spent a considerable amount of effort reading the Bible carefully. I think that's part of our responsibility as Christians. But we also need to read our culture carefully. So that's what I'm trying to do here. It's short, so it's not actually that careful, but anyway. So in his book, The End of Food, Thomas Pollock draws a parallel between the emptying of rural North America and the collectivization of Soviet farms. Both were processes that evicted many, many people off their land. And in some ways, we're not there yet, but in the Soviet Union, it ushered in an era of agricultural disaster. We might be heading there too. In this book, he says the only difference was that the one used the force of the military, and with us, we've used the force of economics. A free market in which the freest are always the richest. In the shift from agriculture to agribusiness in North America and around the globe, haven't the farming Naboths who have lived on their land for generations been bought up or simply booted out by profit-driven agribusinesses? In the first half of the 20th century, more than half of Canadians and Americans lived on farms. First half of the 20th century, not that long ago, more than half of people lived on farms. Today, it's less than 1% of our population. And of course, we are told that this represents the technological advancement of humanity. But I believe it also represents the shift of life and labor on the land to life and labor in a multitude of agro-industrial jobs, and the shift from the ownership by smaller families to land ownership by agribusiness corporations and giants. In many ways, the story of agriculture in North America has been a story of Ahab and Naboth-like dispossession. I offer this example from history of agriculture just as one example. I wonder if you can think of others. So, I started out the sermon by sharing three land-sharing lessons I learned in elementary school, and now I want to conclude with three I learned more recently in theological school. I believe that if we practice these lessons that I've taken from the story of Ahab and Naboth, the Ahab and Naboth story would stop. It wouldn't continue. So, number one, lesson in land sharing. Accept God's ownership of all land, of all the earth. It's God's. Human beings are like squabbling children fighting over our toys. We need a heavenly parent to resolve our disputes. Our hope for peace lies in recognizing the authority of our Heavenly Parent who has given us land to share. Whatever land we own, we are in fact only leasing it from God. We are stewards on God's land, and we are called to use that land to further God's interests. So I'm not saying I'm against private property, but however we figure that out, that issue of ownership, we've got to be able to talk about how this is God's land and God's interests are being worked out in our ownership, in our arrangements. So the final line in the folk song put it well. This land was made for you and me. Land is made by God, and God has made the land to be shared. Made for you and me. The Bible puts it well as well. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. In our story today, we saw how Naboth put this lesson into practice, even when it went against the will of the king. So that's the first lesson. Accept God's ownership of all land. Lesson number two is accept your partiality. By partiality, I don't mean your bad judgment, but your particularity. The word part being impartiality and particularity. Accept your smallness. Accept your limitedness. Accepting our partiality means being content, finding our little place in God's world and rejoicing in it. This is a lesson that Ahab did not learn. Like Ahab, we are all tempted to make and take more than our fair share. What makes this lesson even harder for us to learn, I think, is that in our culture, greed is practically considered a virtue. However, as the famous American writer Wendell Berry says, one can become whole only by the responsible acceptance of one's partiality. Accepting one's partiality. One cannot live in the world as a world citizen. There is no such thing as a global village. We can live fully in this world only by living responsibly in our small part of it. Where we live and who we live therewith define the terms of our relationship to the world and to humanity. So another way of saying what Wendell Berry is saying is, don't own more than you can love. Love the world by loving your little corner of it well. Accepting your partiality is another way of expressing what I believe the Hebrew prophets were on about. When they talk about everyone having their own land and sitting under their own vine, their own fig tree, with no one to make them afraid. As Mennonites, one of our favorite texts in the Old Testament is the one about beating our swords into plowshares. But that text goes on to talk about how those plowshares are used. They're used on the land. They're used by everyone in their own field, cultivating their own vineyard and sitting under their own fig tree. In other words, the restoration of equal land shares is part of what peace looks like. The disarmament piece is one part of peace, and then the restoration of land sharing is the other piece. A peace. So we accept our partiality. As the king of Israel, Ahab should have had this prophetic vision. But instead, Ahab let greed get the best of him. And so it is with us. As long as our desire to have more is greater than our desire to live in a world where everyone can sit under their own fig tree, the story of Ahab and Naboth will continue. So that's the second lesson. The third lesson, this is the last one, it's accept your responsibility. In our story, we saw that Naboth's murder was nobody's fault. It was everybody's fault. The people who stoned Naboth to death were responsible. The people who knew that Naboth was innocent but didn't say anything were responsible. The sons of Belial who falsely accused Naboth were responsible. The elders and nobles who set up Naboth were responsible. And of course, Jezebel and Ahab were responsible too. Too often we evade questions of responsibility with an attitude of ignorance is bliss. We magnify the guilt of others and minimize our own guilt. This is a problem. We must learn the lessons, the third lesson of land sharing, which is to accept our responsibility, however small it might be. We must accept our responsibility to know as much as we can about the impact that our choices have on people around the world. Sadly, we are often like Ahab, who never asks, or Jezebel, who never tells. Ahab's rationale for wanting Naboth's vineyard was that it was convenient. Convenience is great, but the truth is that just because something is convenient and just because we can afford it doesn't mean we should assume it's rightfully ours to have. Accepting responsibility means asking questions about how our choices influence others. Finally, accepting our responsibility includes speaking to Ahab as Elijah spoke to Ahab. There are many Naboths in this world who do not have a voice. We are called to be their voice. And when God calls us to be their voice, we must accept our responsibility to confront Ahab's. Three powerful lessons in Lanshe, right? Accept God's ownership, accept our partiality, and then accept our responsibility. So I want to conclude with my own version of "This Land is Your Land." I'll invite you to join on the last line. So, "This land is your land, this land is my land, from Naboth's vineyard to Ahab's palace, from the Jezreel Valley to the Fraser Valley.
This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from prairie farmlands to cattle ranches, from global markets to the Oak Street shopping mall.
This land was made for you and me."
Amen.